So the topic that's been kind of up for me to talk about today is say something about desire, or maybe a little bit about desirelessness, but I don't know if that's appropriate. But to talk about desire, I think one of the interesting things we become aware of as we kind of start paying attention to our life carefully and what goes on in our minds and is the forces and power of desire. I think, you know, they say the world, love makes the world go around. And maybe it does, but certainly desire contributes. The many forces of desire. And it can be incredibly powerful, the forces of desire. So powerful that some of us, both as individuals as and as a collective, get swept up by it. And seemingly it's the desire that is in control and not we. You know, that we are kind of lost blindly in our desires. Anybody who's, gone to the refrigerator and realized it after the fact has been caught up perhaps in a movement of desire. And it can be much more powerful than that, as we all know. And it's very interesting to notice this, the force and the power and the directions of desire. And noticing about desire and talking about desire, I thought of mentioning that sometimes in the Buddhist tradition, they use the mountain as an analogy or as a symbol for the path to awakening, to enlightenment, to freedom. And as many traditions do, it's a kind of classic and universal kind of analogy almost. And for example, you have this story that, you know, there's many roads going up the mountain, but there's only one top of the mountain. And people who want to say that all religions lead to the same place. It's just different roads going up to the mountain. That's a common theme you might hear. A particular Buddhist twist on this idea of a mountain is that the Buddhist path is described as involving both going up the mountain and coming back down the mountain. And so this is a very important thing to remember. It involves kind of both. And going up the mountain in simplistic ways to follow the path to enlightenment, to freedom. And to come down the mountain is to come down, once a person has become free to some degree, is to come down the mountain and be of service to the community. Not to kind of stay up on the mountain peak by yourself, but to come down again into the world which you left behind. And that has many different meanings, what it means to come back into the world you left behind, to go up to the top of the mountain. And because I think it doesn't necessarily just mean back to the external world. It also means paradoxically or oddly or ironically or painfully, you come back into your own inner world also. The inner world of desires, of attachments, of fears and aversions that a person leaves behind as they go up the mountain, as they become more settled on themselves, more concentrated, more mindful. As they go up the mountain, usually, as you come down the mountain, some of that comes back, but it comes back in a very different way, perhaps, or with a different. We have a different relationship to it than we had it before. So the desires might still be there, but the desires aren't the stage director anymore. The desires aren't in the driver's seat. That something else is in the driver's seat. There's no driver anymore, but. or no steering wheel, so it doesn't matter. So the desires are there, but the desires tend not to latch on so strongly or tend not to have such great power in our lives. But so going up the mountain involves a big part of going up the mountain involves really becoming an expert, really seeing clearly what the desires of our life are. And there are many, many desires. And, you know, there's certainly you know, you can go through and make a list. There's desire for food, there's a desire for security, there's a desire for money, there's a desire for relationships, to be in relationships, there's a desire for companionship, there's a desire for recreation, there's a desire for status, for praise, there's a desire for work, you know, so many, many desires a person can have. And as we notice these different directions of desire, we can also then notice what else is involved with these desires. Are these desires, what else comes along with these desires, these many multitudinous desires we have each moment and each day as we go along. And what, if you pay attention, one of the things you'll notice is that some desires have with them anxiety or stress. Some of them involve a kind of painful reaching forward and leaning forward and kind of losing oneself in the leaning forward. And some desires don't have that so much. And actually some desires, rather than kind of a tightening and constricting or narrowing of our vision and who we are, some desires will actually help us become more open and connected, more intimate to the world around us. I don't know if this is the best example, but that's you can see this, for example, with desire for a relationship with someone. There can be a desire in that relationship that's primarily just one of lust, and it's, you know, there's a kind of intimacy that comes with lust, but there's also a kind of separation and a kind of not seeing the other person, not really knowing the other person very well, usually in that kind of situation. And sometimes it actually ends up being quite painful for everyone. And and in the same time, there can be desire for a relationship which doesn't close our vision to who the other person really is, but rather is an opening to the other person, and we kind of open and see who they are in their deepest heart, and what their pains and their sufferings and joys are. And the way we want to relate to them sees them as a full person, not as simply an object of our desire. So we start seeing many different aspects, faces of desire as we study it. And the more faces we start seeing of desire, the more we can kind of get a sense of which desires seem appropriate and healthy for us to kind of live with, and which desires seem to be kind of unhealthy. And it isn't that any one desire is bad. It isn't desire in and of itself is bad, but rather it's the way in which, that extra way in which we relate to desire, or the consequences of our desire, which we learn to study and we become aware of. And we see that some desires cause us more pain and suffering than we had before we had the desire, and some desires tend to lead us to greater ease or comfort or in our life. And what is the difference between these two kinds of desires? It's a very interesting thing to study. Some of the kinds of desires that cause suffering are actually often the ones that if we start studying them, we realize that they often arise out of some sense of dissatisfaction. The desires that tend to cause suffering arise out of some kind of dissatisfaction. So there's a kind of suffering that even precedes the painful kinds of desires we might have. So for example, someone feels lonely, which is a kind of uncomfortable feeling. And then, and because of that feeling of loneliness, there's a desire to kind of somehow comfort oneself or avoid it or do something about it. And so maybe you go to the refrigerator. Or maybe you're going to go after a sexual partner or something to fill that hole. But there's a way in which we kind of have unhealthy responses to our primary discomfort, which is very real, not to be discounted. So, and there can be many kind of feelings, many dissatisfactory feelings we have inside of ourselves that are the stimulus, the motivation for desires. And as we become experts and kind of really study our desires, be interested in our desires, we can often become aware of this deeper level of dissatisfaction that underlies the stress-producing kinds of desires, the unhealthy kind of desires we might have. The kind of healthy desires we might have can either tend to come from this place of satisfaction, being satisfied, we don't need anything, there's kind of basic satisfaction there already. Or it can come from a very healthy relationship with the feeling of dissatisfaction within us. When we feel dissatisfied about something, uncomfortable, and if we can learn how to relate to that dissatisfaction in a way that doesn't try to deny it or push it away or numb it out or change it too quickly, but there's a kind of paradoxical way where we can be at ease with being uneasy. We can be comfortable with being uncomfortable. We can be at something like that. It's okay to feel dissatisfaction. It's okay to feel lonely. Wow, I'm feeling terrible. It feels painful. Can it be okay for me just to feel it this way? One of the great usefulness of something like a mindfulness practice is that by bringing clear seeing or clear presence to desires, especially to the unhealthy desires, but to all kinds of desire, the clear presence to it, we can often, the clear presence itself, the clear seeing and recognition of desire, that clear recognition is not the desire. And if we bring something which is not the desire to the desire, then we're much less likely to be caught up in the desire. We realize that who we are is much more than the desire. And one of the great, for some people, one of the great revolutionary discoveries is that we don't have to be our desires. Our desires don't define who we are. Our desires don't have to be believed. Our desires don't have to be fulfilled. A desire is just a desire. A desire is just one particular event in a universe of many different things. But there's often a very strong identification we have with desires. My desire, my need, what I want, what I should have, what there's a tremendous amount of I that often gets added to the desire. And it's this often enough, it's this addition of me and mine that gets added onto the desire, which gives some of the power to the desire to kind of, you know, to take over. As we bring clear perception, clear wakefulness to the fact, oh, there's a strong desire here. It's kind of like we create room, and there's more of us than just what the desire is, and we can let the desire be there without having to latch on to it. And that's incredibly powerful. That is a kind of liberation, a kind of freedom. To see there's a desire and you don't have to do anything about it. Wow, what a radical thing. So you see a desire, wow, this is, and it's a, you feel, and it might be very strong, and it might even be uncomfortable. Wow, it's an uncomfortable desire. You know, I remember, so one of the, in the Buddhist tradition, I think probably in a lot of religious traditions, one of the dividing lines between healthy and unhealthy desires is how much self there is in the desire. And the movement that we often try to study is the desire selfish or not? And this dividing line between selfish desires and desires which are not selfish is also the division that distinguishes going up the mountain and coming down the mountain. The selfish desires are all about me and myself, or sometimes it's extended beyond, and a particular community, your family or your little community or something, ethnic community or national community or whatever, can have tremendous desire, can be swept up in desires. But there's kind of a selfish nature and even sometimes collective desires. It's me against them. This is what I deserve. This is what I'm supposed to have. Forget about anybody else. You know, I get to go get, you know, let me kind of... So today in the Chronicle, there was a list of what, the 102, 108 top... I don't know what exactly it was. I didn't really read the article. I didn't have to. They write it every year. You know, the top executives in the Bay Area who get the most compensation or whatever. And they have their pictures, you know. Who cares? Except it was interesting because I went down to see, I looked at the pictures to see how many women were there. Well, at the bottom of the list, there were 3 women out of the 108. So, Why was I saying that?
Desire.
So someone's coined the word affluenza. Some people are addicted to it, or kind of, and it's affluenza is a good expression, because there's a way in which it's contagious. And I think probably all of us are very susceptible to this disease. And I think when we see around us people living with under the influence of affluenza and becoming very affluent, and it's kind of a little bit hard then to kind of, you know, not be one of the gang. Feel a little bit outside, or you know, you didn't make it. And so then we have this desire, you know, I so the desire then becomes, well, I better make it. I better become someone important. You know, so I can't be driving around this beat up car anymore, because, you know, then I'm not one of the gang and I'm not so important. So I better go out and lease a big car. So selfish desires that are for me and mine, just this is what I want. So when I was buying a car some years ago, I remember I went to a test drive of the car, and the salesman said, you should think about getting an air conditioner. And he said very wisely, everything changes all the time. So I didn't quite know what that had to do with air conditioners, but weren't climate changes all the time. So, you know, when I was in Tennessee, they lived in Tennessee, they said, if you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes. Then he said, after that, he said to me, you deserve an air conditioner. You've worked hard, you know, and you know, I deserve an air conditioner. But you know, this has been a theme for the last, I don't know, I hear this expression a lot in the last 10 years. People say, you know, I deserve something. I deserve it. You know, I deserve this particular thing. And it sounds kind of selfish to me, that idea, I deserve. Does anybody deserve anything? There's a beautiful, on the memorial stone for Gandhi in India, there's a beautiful quote that, and now I don't remember it very well, but it's a quote of Gandhi. He says something like, do you know, Mira, what that quote is?
No, I don't. Where was it?
It's on his memorial stone, apparently. I haven't been there, but
oh, okay.
It says something like, to paraphrase, when you're going to consider you're going to consider any kind of decision to do something, you should consider whether this is bring to mind the poorest person you can think of in the world somehow, and then consider whether your decision is somehow or other impact or help that person. I thought that was a beautiful thing. So selfish desires, and I think it's kind of a koan, it's kind of a challenge to us. You know, what is it to be selfish? What is the nature of selfishness? When are we selfish and when are we not selfish? I don't think it's, you know, necessarily kind of obvious what selfishness is always. But to investigate, you know, what's behind this decision? What's behind this desire? Am I buying an air conditioner because, you know, I want to prove, you know, or am I buying this particular car because I want to be seen in a certain way? Am I pursuing a certain kind of, you know, a desire because it's going to enhance who I am? Now, what's interesting about coming down the mountain is that there's also desires. When you get to the top of the mountain, is that as you go up the mountain, the force and the pull and desires becomes less and less. until there's actually absolutely no movement of mind or heart towards grabbing on or latching onto any desire at all. And then at some point, in the top of the mountain is the ability to rest. In this, in one definition of the top of the mountain for Buddhists is in wishlessness, without any kind of wish at all, and to find some kind of tremendous sense of well-being and security or happiness or appropriateness, satisfactoriness, a sense of maybe who we are in our deepest sense, in a state that has no desire at all, that we don't need to fulfill a desire in order to discover who we most deeply are. And to kind of rest in that moment is really, really precious. Because if you can kind of get a taste of that, then you realize that the desires for something external that's going to do it for us, if that's what desires are going to, you know, what's behind the desire is going to, you know, fix us once and for all. But only, if only mind. You had that, if only mind? If only I have that car, if only I have that job, if only if I have that relationship, if only if I have that house, if only if I have that, you know, if only, then everything will be okay. But actually, everything that we need to be complete and full in ourselves, to be deeply settled and happy in this life, is here already. It's not like a matter of only. We don't have to, nothing has to change externally. And to be constantly having our desires go externally often prevents us from doing the deep spiritual work, which can only happen here in this particular moment. One of the paradoxes of this is the tremendous suffering associated with spiritual desire. The desire for liberation, the desire for something great, the great longing for some great spiritual experience or some great spiritual intimacy or some great spiritual whatever. Sometimes the very desire that comes into doing a practice is unhealthy, is stress-producing, painful-producing, and it removes or separates us from ourselves. The desire to attain something, to get something out of a practice, very subtly or very grossly separates us from ourselves. Because we're looking into the future for the answer. And the really radical thing about Buddhist practice is the answer will never be in the future. The answer is right here, right now, as you are. Right here, the ultimate truth of Buddhism is in the discomfort you feel in your legs sitting here right now, or the discomfort you feel in your back, or the tiredness you have right now, or just listening to my voice, or the airplane above, or it's, you know, the lighting in the room, and it's here. You know, and can we be here? Can we rest? Can we find our rest and our place here right now? So to get to the top of the mountain, in a sense, is to realize that there's nowhere else but here. And it isn't that, you know, at the top of the mountain sounds really grandiose, you know, like, wow, you get to kind of like climbing the Himalayas, you know, and you huff and you puff, and it's a great struggle. But the mountain isn't someplace else. Each of us sits on top of our own mountain each moment. So coming down the mountain, desires have a very different flavor. And desires then are no longer wedded to our selfishness. But rather than eliminating our desires and having no desires at all, this is where our desires are born then from a wider sense of connectedness with the world around us. So one way of saying this is that our desires and our sentiments, our feelings and emotional connections in Buddhism begin to get universalized. They move rather than denying ourselves, our desires move beyond ourselves. Rather than saying, well, you know, I want money, I want sex, I want whatever we want, and that's bad, and therefore I'm going to be an ascetic, and I'm going to go be an ascetic practitioner somewhere and deny my desires. The movement that's possible, I believe, is not so much to deny the desires, but to understand how the desires can be expanded to become boundless, to include all beings, to include everything, so that in the same sense that that quote by Gandhi, so that our desires, our wishes, that are very deep and very, you know, really who we are in a sense, are not selfish anymore, but rather intimately connected to the people in the community around us. So what we want is really what we want for the widest community around. And as the practice becomes stronger and more mature, that sense of being in community becomes more and more universal. And at least in theory, at the fulfillment of it, it has no bounds. It's boundless. And so the sense of desire is, our desires, is intimately connected to everything in the world. And this has expression in, beautiful expression in Mahayana Buddhism with the Bodhisattva vows, where they say, beings are numberless, I vow to save them all. And this idea that beings are numberless, I vow to save them all, is the kind of the taking our desires and bursting our desires beyond the confines of our selfishness. Isn't that a beautiful thing? So rather than denying our selfishness, what can we do with our desires that expands and extends it beyond our particular individual selfish desires, when that's the case? So desires are very interesting. So you might spend a few days looking at your desires.
Can you give an example of expanding a desire beyond themselves?
Well, I don't know if, I mean, I'll tell you what first came to mind. And I don't know if it's a good one. When I was, last time I was traveling and practicing in Asia, I was there for a year and a half. And I went to Asia with very little money, relatively. For me, it was a lot, but I think I had $2,000 for the whole trip. And most of that money was spent for airfares and to get there and back, and to fly between Thailand and Burma and Thailand and Nepal and India, travel around. So I didn't have much money. And at some point I was in Nepal, and I had enough airfare to fly back to America at some point when I had to. And I had, I think, in addition to that, I think I had $300. And I was in Asia for the duration. I was there for, I was just, you know, there to practice, and I was there for whoever, you know, I had no other agendas or had nothing else to do except practice, and that's where I was. I had $300. And I was walking down the, I was waiting for this retreat to start, and I was walking around Kathmandu, and they have a lot of Buddhist art stores in Kathmandu, and they have windows, you know, with all these Buddhist artifacts. And I saw a Buddhist statue that I fell in love with. I was extremely, I was drawn to it very, very strongly. I thought, this is really a great statue. I really would like this. And it was $100. So, a third of my wealth. So, a significant amount of money. So, I spent, and I really wanted it. And it was, I would say, you know, it's, I don't know if it was all selfish, but the desire to have it. But, you know, I wanted to possess this beautiful thing. And so I spent, since it was a third of my wealth, you know, I didn't just kind of go in there and buy it like that, but I spent a couple of days considering, you know, whether this is what I should do or not today. And in the end, I decided that no matter how beautiful this statue was, what was more beautiful was a purified mind. And I was going to, rather than buying the statue, I would use that money, if the opportunity arose, to help someone else practice so that they could maybe have a taste of a purified mind. And the next day, somewhat out of the blue, my girlfriend arrived from America to practice together with me. And she had less money than I. So it was very good that I had that, didn't buy that statue. Because then I was able to help her so she could practice. Is that the... So the idea that, that you know, I wasn't going to do it just for... You know, I had this opportunity to do something for myself, But I thought there was something more important than myself. And when I felt what was more important than myself, that there was a desire, that this deeper desire, this more universal desire, was actually stronger and more important for me. The desire for the statue kind of evaporated. It had no particular, you know, it didn't pull me anymore, because it was this stronger desire that captivated me, this universal desire. So there's a way in which, rather than necessarily doing away or cutting off our small selfish desires, one strategy that's sometimes talked about is to actually let our desires become larger than our selfish desires, or discover that part of it which is larger, and nurture that. So I think we should stop, so that the because our desire should be helping the polling person. So if some people could help, that would be very nice. And thank you for your attention.